This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 12, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Less than 1 week into his new presidency, Colombian President Uribe declares a state of emergency. Another Texas execution. This time the Mexican government is making a last-minute petition for clemency. And the Bush administration threatens to bring in the military if West Coast dock workers strike. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Airways, one of the nation's largest airlines, filed for bankruptcy today, saying they need time and money to recover from the reduced consumer travel following the September 11th attacks. Labor unions at U.S. Air reportedly responded with mixed reactions to the news, since management has been threatening filing for bankruptcy in contract negotiations with pilots, flight attendants, and the machinists union for months. The airline says they will try to obtain employee buyouts before cutting jobs, and the 12,000-strong machinists union will vote on terms they received from management yesterday by the end of this month. Industry analysts say other major air carriers may also soon ask for new financial arrangements. Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld says he wants to expand the use of covert operations in other countries. Joshua Chaffin reports from D.C.
U.S. covert operations are conducted by the CIA, but Defense Secretary Rumsfeld proposes the military start conducting their own special operations. Bill Christensen, retired as head of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis, he says expanded covert operations would kill far fewer innocent civilians than the U.S. is currently killing in bombing runs over Afghanistan. But he's wary of any new Pentagon powers to okay the secret missions.
The use of covert action should not be made any easier. It should be made more difficult. This is not anything that should ever be delegated to somebody below the president.
Today's New York Times says Pentagon proposals include longer-term covert operations in countries where the U.S. is not at war. According to a Senate report, since the 1960s, the U.S. has supported assassinations or assassination attempts of the leaders of the Dominican Republic, the Congo, Iraq, Cuba, Chile, and South Vietnam. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
Today, Zimbabwe's president reiterated his hard-line stance against more than 2,900 white farmers. Naeem Jinnah has more from Johannesburg.
The much-awaited speech by Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe did not bring the relief white farmers hoped it would. In his Heroes Day address today, Mugabe told those that were defying an eviction order from his government that he stood by his deadline. 2,900 white commercial farmers were ordered to surrender farmland to landless black people by midnight last Thursday. Farmer representatives say about 40% of the farmers had obeyed the instruction. Mugabe insists his deadline must be adhered to so as to allow new farmers sufficient time to plant for the new season, which starts in October. But the situation for the farmers is not as bad as they make it out to be. A spokesperson for the Commercial Farmers Union said Mugabe had toned down his speech, suggesting that the situation could be worse. And Zimbabwe's president said that farmers who cooperated with the government would be able to continue farming. He has promised that each farmer would be allowed to keep one farm. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naeem Jinnah in Johannesburg.
The 2-mile-thick cloud of pollution hanging over South Asia is threatening agriculture, changing rainfall patterns, and damaging human health, according to a United Nations Environment Program report released today. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
The report says the cloud, a mix of ash, acids, aerosols, and other particles, is threatening the lives of millions of people with dire implications for economic growth and health. UN officials say the cloud has global implications because it can travel halfway around the globe in a week. Officials say the cloud, which is about 2 miles thick, is the result of forest fires, the burning of agricultural wastes, and dramatic increases in the burning of fossil fuels. The report recommends more research and international cooperation to stop the growth of this cloud. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
And government authorities are investigating over 500 small businesses owned by Muslim and Arab people to establish whether they have funded terrorist activities abroad. Gareth Schweitzer has more from the Capitol.
FBI and customs officials believe these businesses, many of which are convenience stores, are merely fronts to funnel profits from drug and cigarette smuggling and petty scams to terrorist organizations. Houdan Hassan, spokeswoman of the Council of American Islamic Relations, believes the FBI is engaging in racial profiling.
This is primarily based on the race and religion of the small convenience store owners. At this point, they haven't indicated that the 500 or so stores have engaged in questionable activity.
The FBI would not comment on the investigation. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Colombia's new president, Álvaro Uribe, has declared a state of emergency in Colombia in an attempt, his administration says, to quell the violence of both the left-wing guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries that have seen dozens dead since last Wednesday's inauguration. Correspondent Stephen Dudley joins us with the latest from Bogotá.
They're calling it a state of internal commotion, essentially the same thing as a state of emergency. There are some restrictions to what they can do. They can't try civilians in military courts, and supposedly they can't have any restrictions on the press. Other than that, they can pretty much make the rules as they want. This means that we could find more restrictions on public protests. There probably will be a lot more search and seizures and possibly even more arrests of suspected guerrillas. So this is essentially what people are looking at right now. People here are, in general, they're very calm about it. The conflict here has been going on for 40 years. In addition to that, I should mention that people here voted in strong numbers for Uribe. The president here, Álvaro Uribe, was elected by a landslide on his campaign of hardline and very much stricter types of requirements for people in the streets and trying to make sure that the guerrilla groups here do not just go out of control.
Now, Steve, Uribe had also said he was going to implement a million-man militia, civilian militia. Is this state of emergency the beginnings of this militia?
Actually, he implemented what he's calling the civilian network some days before. He said that he was going to use this civilian man militia as sort of the eyes and ears of the government, and it doesn't have anything to do, if you will, with the calling of the state of internal commotion. The state of internal commotion will deal with things that are much closer to the activities of the Attorney General's office, for instance. They'll have more powers to, as I said, do search and seizures and arrest people, possibly keep people in detention for several days without even charging them for anything. So they're actually two separate proposals, but both towards the same end, which is to sort of curb the growth of the guerrilla groups here.
Steve, can you tell us what the reaction has been in the streets of Bogota in Colombia to this state of internal commotion or state of emergency, which essentially gives the president many, many new and sweeping powers?
Well, the debate, interestingly enough, has been going on for several months since the president decided that he was going to name a person named Fernando Londoño as the Interior and Justice Minister. Londoño has come out and said that he wanted to revive what they call the state of siege before, and that sort of sparked the debate. And since then, people have essentially come across on two sides. One is that the country needs this type of action. That without this type of action, without these type of measures, they won't be able to slow the growth of guerrilla groups here. And then the other, of course, is general worry, worry that eventually people will have to. Civilians will have to face military tribunals, that their phones will be tapped, that their houses will be searched without warrants. These are sort of, that's sort of the two sides that have come down. But it remains to be seen exactly what type of measures they're going to implement with this decree.
Correspondent Stephen Dudley joining us there from Bogota. This Wednesday, the state of Texas is set to execute its third person this month, with another three August executions still to come. But this particular execution, that of Mexican national Javier Suarez Medina, is straining international relations with the United States. Medina was arrested for the shooting death of an undercover police officer, Larry Cadena, during a 1988 drug bust in Dallas, Texas, but he was never informed of his right to consular assistance at the time of his arrest. The Mexican government has written to Governor Rick Perry and spoken with Secretary of State Colin Powell requesting clemency in Suarez's case. Renee Feltz reports from Houston, Texas.
The Mexican government heard about the arrest, recognized that he had a Hispanic surname, called the Dallas County authorities, believe it was the prosecutor's office, asked if he was a Mexican national, and they were told that he was Cuban. And in fact, they were misinformed three different times about his nationality.
Attorney Sandra Babcock is the director of the Mexican Capital Legal Aid Program, leading the reinvestigation into Medina's case. During his confession, Medina identified himself to Dallas police as a Mexican national and handed over the green card he had in his wallet. Yet, in two follow-up phone calls, the Mexican consulate was told that the nationality of Medina was either unknown or that he was Colombian. Texas's deliberate misinforming of the consulate violates Article 36 of the Vienna Convention on International Relations. Mark Warren, director of Human Rights Research, an organization that focuses on international law issues and death penalty cases, explains.
When a police officer arrests or detains a foreign citizen anywhere in the U.S., they must notify that national that they have the right to communicate with their consulate.
Lydia Brandt, the attorney now representing Medina, argues that the Mexican consulate would have provided legal assistance to Javier had they not been misinformed about his nationality. Instead, Medina was represented by a court-appointed attorney who did not speak Spanish, and there were no Latinos on the Dallas County jury. Texas's denial of his consular rights was never raised during the trial, and due to the language barrier between the court and Medina's parents, mitigating evidence from his personal history was never presented. Lydia Brandt.
About a year or two before this particular crime was committed, he had been with several friends at a party, and there was a drive-by shooting, and he saw another boy about his age who was just picked off by a gun and shot right in front of him, shot dead. The psychologist, Dr. Weinstein, has opined that Javier was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and so when he pulled the trigger and shot Officer Cadena after having heard what he thought were shots, it was this panic reaction.
Brandt also argues that the prosecution used unreliable eyewitness testimony from a separate case for which Javier was never tried or convicted in order to demonstrate future dangerousness and further convince the jury to level a death sentence. In a statement adopted last Thursday, the UN Subcommission on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights argued that Medina's right to a fair trial was impaired. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has issued a precautionary measure to the State Department calling for a stay in Medina's case while they investigate possible rights violations. And, in a significant move last week, the State Department contacted the Texas governor and the Board of Pardon and Parole, suggesting clemency for Medina. Sandra Babcock.
I think that state governments and politicians are more likely to defer to a recommendation by our own State Department as opposed to a recommendation from a foreign government.
The Texas Board of Pardons and Parole has indicated it is aware of requests by the Mexican government, Medina's attorney, and the State Department for a stay of execution. Perry's office has declined comment on his response to requests for clemency until the board issues its decision. International critics suggest that since there is no punishment for violations of consular rights, the United States is likely to continue ignoring this right. The only measure taken in the past when a foreign national was executed without the opportunity to exercise this right has been a posthumous apology from the State Department. If Medina receives a stay, his case will be appealed to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, where Brandt will present new evidence. If a stay is not issued, the case will be appealed to the United States Supreme Court, accompanied by an amicus brief filed by Mexico and 11 other countries. Currently, Javier Suarez Medina is scheduled to die by lethal injection at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. I'm Renee Feltz in Houston, Texas, for Free Speech Radio News.
As dock workers and their supporters rallied this afternoon in Oakland's ports, President Bush is threatening to bring in the National Guard if contract talks between the West Coast Longshore Union and the Pacific Maritime Association aren't settled. The Bush administration threatened the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen Union, the ILWU, with the War Powers Act as early as May on grounds of national security. Since July 1st, when the contract expired and labour talks were extended, the administration has threatened federal intervention to prevent an economically crippling strike or slowdown. The ILWU has neither engaged in a slowdown since talks were extended, nor threatened to strike. Yet. However, if the administration acts on threats to bring in the military, or other actions it's considering, such as new legislation to challenge the union's coastwide contract and its legal right to bargain collectively, that may change. Martha Baskin has the story.
The administration's threats have drawn a line in the sand in the high-stakes drama between one of the country's most powerful unions, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, and the Pacific Maritime Association, representing cargo carriers, shipping companies, and terminal operators on the west coast of the U.S. The threat to bring in the military, justified in the context of a possible work slowdown or strike occurring during what the administration calls wartime, is ominous enough.
But special legislation to take away our rights to collective bargaining and to strike, these are rights that were granted American workers with the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. The National Labor Relations Act is a landmark civil rights act for workers.
Steve Stallone, ILWU spokesperson.
They basically want to take away what is pretty much the only power a union has. Understand that we're talking about 10,000 blue-collar workers versus an employer association of 79 multinational, multi-billion dollar companies. But for them, Bush is going to take away the civil rights of American workers.
Anxious shippers and retailers, Walmart, Panasonic, Toyota, Nike, 3M, turned up the heat early on by asking President Bush to intervene before talks were completed. The National Retail Federation warned that a strike, the last strike occurred in 1971, could undermine the U.S. economic recovery and affect the nation's ability to protect ports from terrorist attacks. In mid-May, the White House convened a working group to monitor the talks with representatives from the Departments of Commerce, Defense, Labor, and the Office of Homeland Security. A Labor Department official has met with the Union Negotiating Committee twice and made almost daily phone calls. The Department of Labor would only confirm that they view the negotiations in a serious manner and hope both sides will keep the national interest in focus. During the last contract negotiations in 1996 and 1999, the union engaged in what are known as work-to-rule actions mandated in their contract, punching in at 8, taking federally allowed breaks and lunches, and clocking out at 5. The Pacific Maritime Association views the actions as slowdowns, verging on a strike. Jack Sweet, director of contract administration for the Pacific Maritime Association, says the union was told going into the negotiations that
they were to repeat the same tactic that they've employed in the last two negotiations, this strike that they've conducted against us with their slowdown, that we would be forced to take some form of defensive action.
Both sides say neither is bargaining seriously, and both remain far apart on key jurisdictional issues. For the union, that means making sure that the actual work of loading and documenting the cargo remains the job of the ILWU wherever it is done, off the docks because of diminishing port space, or as far away as Singapore. After a bitter strike in 1934, the union won two sacred principles, a coastwide contract so that the employer couldn't leapfrog from a union port to a non-union port, and the hiring hall, jointly operated by the union and the employer.
If this administration comes after the coastwide contract, this administration will do more to upset and harm the nation's economy because these are fighting words.
David Olson, political science professor at the University of Washington.
And I can only surmise that this administration views the longshore as too powerful, as too militant, as too rank-and-file controlled, as too racially integrated, as too threatening to some kind of object in the economic system. And they've chosen to throw the sword down. When you do this on the docks, the sword is going to bounce back up again, and we're talking about a major conflagration on the waterfront.
The AFL-CIO has vowed to make the administration's threats to the ILWU a top priority of the American labor movement. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
As the Bush administration threatens war and assassination for rogue states that violate biological and chemical warfare, the government's multi-million dollar joint non-lethal weapons directorate is looking into the use of certain chemicals, or calmatives for crowd control in military operations where lethal force is undesirable. Patrick Burke has this report.
Edward Hammond is co-director of the Sunshine Project, an international biological and chemical weapons watchdog group. In addition to government documents, his organization has acquired reports produced by Penn State. The university has been conducting research into the feasibility of so-called calmatives as non-lethal weapons. The Penn State research identifies drugs such as Valium, Prozac, and morphine as possible pharmacological weapons.
They also said that what the military should do is to look into club drugs, meaning illegal narcotics, as a means to control people, and also to look into failed drugs. So drugs that were isolated by a pharmaceutical company but which had excessive side effects or were not effective for their designated use, but which might be effective in knocking people out or making people passive, afraid, unable to express their will and therefore more controllable by the military.
Captain Sean Turner is a public affairs officer for the Marines. He denies that there is any current funding for calmative development.
Calmatives, calming agents, are not currently in the U.S. inventory. They're not currently funded for acquisition. I will say, however, that it's a technology that the Department of Defense, the Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate, is interested in looking at.
Turner adds that the directorate is meticulous in its efforts not to violate international treaties. In November 2000, U.S. and U.K. officials met to discuss, among other things, the potential problems with developing calmatives. The Chemical Weapons Convention was acknowledged as an obstacle. In the summarizing document, the U.S. team stated that it was illegal for the Department of Defense to develop calmatives, but that the Departments of Justice and Energy were free to do so. Edward Hammond.
This is complete fiction, because it's akin to Saddam Hussein saying, I can develop biological weapons if I have my agriculture ministry do it instead of having my military do it. It's completely false. The treaty applies, and the U.S. law to implement it applies to everyone.
The Chemical Weapons Convention does allow domestic use of some chemicals, such as pepper spray, to control riots. It does not, however, allow the use or development of incapacitating chemicals. Meanwhile, the National Institute of Justice, a faction of the Department of Justice, is funding research at Penn State to assess the feasibility of combining calmatives with pepper spray in non-lethal bullets. Vicky Fong is a spokesperson for Penn State. She says that the study will determine whether calmative chemicals would decrease the adverse physical reactions that some people have to pepper spray.
I think it is a matter of question of you know, what is effective, but also what is humane. Again, the goal is to deal with thousands of perhaps large crowds and conflicts with the least minimal amount of impact on people.
Captain Sid Hale of the L.A. Sheriff's Department worked with Penn State researchers to assess the quality of non-lethal bullet systems. Part of the study dealt with the release of pepper spray from these bullets upon impact, already a common practice in law enforcement. Hale says that calmative agents in this capacity would have the advantage of compatibility with other chemicals, which would facilitate the process of psychological control.
The advantage of the calmative agents is that you can also use a counter agent. And the other thing is that they also have chemicals now that enhance the effects without requiring them to be inhaled.
The Sunshine Project has turned over documents from government labs that propose the development of genetically engineered microbes to eat away at asphalt, plastic, and rubber. The group is seeking federal legal action against the Department of Justice for violation of international treaties. From Boston, this is Patrick Burke for Free Speech Radio News.
Talks aimed at ending almost two decades of civil conflict in Sudan are due to resume in Kenya today, in the wake of fresh hostilities and mutual accusations of warmongering. For almost two decades, the southern Sudanese have been battling for independence against the government in the north of the country. It's estimated that more than 2 million people have been killed. The main conflict pits the southern-based Sudan People's Liberation Army against the Islamic Khartoum government. The last round of peace talks made no provisions for a ceasefire, an issue that is expected to dominate the next round of talks, together with wealth sharing and the South's demand for self-rule. The Bush administration, seen as unwilling to be left out of Sudan's oil bonanza, has been involved in the ongoing peace negotiations. Yet, as Rupert Cook reports, for the southern Sudanese civilians, especially the children, the war has had a devastating effect on their future.
Well, I'm in the Catholic Church of Lankien on a Sunday morning at around 8 o'clock. It's a building of around 30 square meters, built in the traditional style.
On any Sunday morning in the Nuer village of Lankien, in the eastern Upper Nile region of southern Sudan, the three churches catering for the community are full to the proverbial rafters. Many of the villagers cite freedom of religious expression as a prime cause in the country's long-running civil war between the predominantly Christian southern Sudanese and the radical Islamist government based in the country's northern capital, Khartoum. However, for the people of Lankien, religious persecution is just one of the afflictions affecting their community. Peter Sott is the head catechist in Lankien's Catholic Church.
Besides the lack of priests for spreading the word of God, the main problem is the lack of schooling. Our children don't have access to any school because our children need to be taught. The other problem is that we don't have any way of getting supplies, in terms of textbooks, for example, and then people are suffering from hunger. People are suffering from different problems, diseases, also hunger, all those kinds of things.
The suffering of the Lankien villagers after decades of relentless conflict is compounded by the lack of basic infrastructure. One of the most crucial needs is the provision of education. A small hut serves as the local school. Its 15-square-meter interior is meant to cater for 172 pupils. There are no books, no writing implements, no chairs, and no trained teacher. James is 11 and a pupil at Lankien School.
He said the school need blackboard, chalks, pen and pencil, textbook, and the school uniform. And the other thing that can support them during the schooling. The school is very important because they want to change the attitude within the community. They want to learn. They want to know the other thing like the other country. They want to live peacefully. They want to study other things like diseases, and then they should have their bright future.
Most of the young children in Lankien talk about growing up to become leaders or military commanders. The lack of role models, save for the various military factions, leaves little choice for the children's ambitions. Yet, the ubiquity of small arms and the constant threat of violence have left many with a deep distrust of the gun. The children of Lankien have seen its devastating impact on the lives of their parents and themselves. Even at an early age, they yearn for a future without the gun. Daniel is 14 and also a pupil at the school in Lankien.
He said the problem for the gun is not good for the civilian, it's good for the soldiers whom have been taught how to handle the gun, and then they are the one that's supposed to keep the gun for themselves. He feels the gun is not good.
Now you want to be a leader. Do you want to have a gun as well?
He said he doesn't want actually to have a gun during his leadership. He thinks that when he become a leadership educated person within the educated people, intellectual people, and then the whole will not need gun, and then they can just handle things without gun.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Lankien, southern Sudan.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.